Hello, everybody, and welcome to the End Credits Radio Show here on CFRU 93.3 FM, CFRU.ca, Guelph Campus and Community Radio. I'm Adam A. Donaldson, your host, and joining me today making his final appearance on End Credits as a bachelor is...
Tim Phillips.
Yes. Yeah. Next time you might hear Tim, he might be officially a kept man.
Yes. Bachelor days are over
right.
as of April 7th.
So. Well, there you go. Mark them on your calendars.
Yeah.
Send him some well wishes. He works very hard on End Credits and other things, and he's going to enjoy this some time off with his new wife in April. And we wish you great congratulations.
Oh, thank you, Adam.
And best of luck on now that you know you're finally embarking on marriage after 12 years of togetherness.
Yeah, exactly. I was a bit slow to propose, but. It's all good.
Better late than never.
Yeah, exactly.
But this isn't The Bachelor. This is End Credits. It's a local movie show for local movie fans. We are here every Wednesday at 2 p.m. to talk the latest in pop culture and review the newest movies, which this week will be the biopic Stan and Ollie. That is in the back half of the show. For the first half, we're going to talk about some of the movie news from the past week, including the Viewmaster movie. And we'll ask the question, why not a Viewmaster TV show? And then somebody with a lot of free time is trying to petition Martin Scorsese to take the rat out of the end of The Departed. Why do people seem to have so much time on their hands and spend it on such silly things? That may take care of itself with this next topic. After that, finally, speaking of too much time, Rotten Tomatoes has forced to take action against trolls, trying to drive down the ratings for Captain Marvel. And what is this another fine example of toxic masculinity online? And why are people so angry about female superheroes when they should be angry about people like John Lasseter still getting work? That's our first topic. So Emma Thompson, renowned actress, Academy Award-winning actress, critically acclaimed actress, wrote a letter last week in which she withdrew her upcoming performance in an animated film called Luck for Skydance Pictures. Skydance is breaking into animation. Skydance is the production company. It's mainly been responsible lately for a lot of big franchise movies like the Star Trek movies and the Mission Impossible movies. They hired John Lasseter, who is one of the co-founders of Pixar, the creative founder of Pixar. Later, the creative director of Pixar and Disney Animation, but in 2018, he had to step away because of several allegations of harassment of female employees of Pixar and Disney Animation. He was then hired at the beginning of the year by Skydance to look after their new animation division, which brings us back to Emma Thompson, who said she is stepping away. And this is kind of a rare thing that someone... Well, it's rare on a couple of levels that we have, in terms of the Me Too era, John Lasseter, sort of like the first Me Too person to actually be able to stage a career comeback of sorts mm-hmm. in any kind of substantial way. But also Emma Thompson's the first person to say, no, I will not take part in this, you trying to rehabilitate yourself.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Yeah, it's interesting. When you read her letter, her full letter, it's quite compelling, and it's hard to argue against it, basically. And given all the allegations against Lasseter, it's hard to see him making a comeback. Especially, I think Emma Thompson had a good point, too. Like, all the people who work at that company, Skydance... they didn't sign on to work with Lasseter.
Yeah.
She did mention, like, if he wanted to start his own company, people would have the choice whether they want to work with him or not. But putting him into that position, you're really making a lot of people uncomfortable at that company,
mm-hmm.
including Emma Thompson. And it just shows the power that she wields being a big star, that she can, her voice is heard. And the letter, I thought, was on point. It's such a great... great letter. It's like she didn't pull any punches yet. It's a great argument against him joining the company. It's hard to argue against, really.
Yeah, I mean, I think that was one of the most compelling points is, and I have the letter here, she said, if John Lasseter started his own company, then every employee would have been given the opportunity to choose whether or not to give him a second chance, but any Skydance employees who don't want to give him a second chance have to stay and be uncomfortable or lose their jobs. Mm-hmm. And speaking of uncomfortable, even this woman, Michelle Soria, who's the head of Paramount Animation, Paramount and Skydance have a corporate relationship, mm-hmm. Said that she was had discomfort, the fact that he was hired. And then you have David Ellison, who's the head of Skydance. He said something to the effect of, I wrote it down somewhere. Lasseter gave assurances that he would comport himself in a wholly professional manner. So he just said, seriously, guys, this time I won't harass female employees.
Yeah.
And, I mean, I think that's probably closest to an admission of guilt.
Mm-hmm.
That has been offered by any of the really Me Too people. I mean, I can't help but think of Louis C.K. too, who last fall was getting on stage in New York comedy clubs. He wasn't being billed, but he would sneak in, and the people running the shows would, let him take part.
Mm-hmm.
But speaking to Emma Thompson's integrity, I haven't heard of any of the comics who are also on the billing that night, stepping away and saying, like, no, I will not share a stage with Louis C.K. Either Louis C.K. goes on or I don't.
Mm-hmm.
In fact, a lot of comedians who, were at these shows have said, oh, great, Louis C.K. is back to form. And it's like, well, mm-hmm. no, the problem was never his comedy routine. The problem was what happens after the comedy routine or between comedy routines when he was pleasuring himself in front of female comics. The work performance isn't the issue.
Right.
Having to get people to promise to comport themselves with professionalism because otherwise they harass people is the problem.
Yeah, and I think the whole culture in Hollywood, probably New York as well, amongst like comedians, actors, it was so toxic for so long that it's hard to do a 180, right away.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
So many people we're used to that culture, male and female, used to that culture. It's just, it's like, how do you, it's hard to like overnight flick a switch and say, okay. So then there's probably a lot of people, a lot of these comedians who are like, yeah, Louis C.K., that was wrong, but they've probably done stuff too, like, like when it started coming out, all these, it's just one after another, it seemed like.
Right.
So it was just like, boys will be boys, let them run amok kind of thing before. And now they're paying the price, which they should. And it's just, it's like ripping off a Band-Aid almost, You just rip it off and you have to start fresh kind of thing.
And I'm not even sure it's a matter of not wanting to let people have second chances. Everybody loves a second act. That's a cliche. Mm-hmm. But it also has the virtue of being true. But I think in the case of the Louis C.K.'s and John Lasseter's is, and I've heard this from other people, they want to see not a promise of comportment. They want to see, actual moves in terms of accepting what they've done and trying to redress it. A lot of people talk about, Louis C.K. lost a TV show. Well, Louis C.K. still has, millions of dollars in the bank.
Mm-hmm.
John Lasseter as well. John Lasseter is still probably enjoying profits from every piece of Frozen paraphernalia that's mm-hmm. still sold, 5 years after that movie came out. So it's not a matter of do they work, do they not work? It's a matter of, do you understand what you did was wrong and have you done enough to address it? Somebody like Louis C.K., for example, could do more to do something to support women comics since, a lot of women comics were the victim of his lechery. John Lasseter too. What has he done to support women in the animation field? Not even just people in his field, but has he done a speaking tour? Mm-hmm. Is talking to classrooms full of film students? We need more women in these classes. Mm-hmm. I have done terrible things to women in our field, and I'm trying to work through how I redress that and how I come forward. But no, they want to go from being kicked out and then a year later going back to work like nothing ever happened, like they were on sabbatical. And I think that's the piece a lot of people have a problem with, that there's missing the reconciliation portion.
Right. And like genuine reconciliation too, because what a lot of them do, like Lasseter, he finds a PR rep who, you know, oh, you've rehabilitated all these other celebrities. Can you do the same for me?
Mm-hmm.
So that's basically him just wanting to get back into the position he formerly had.
Yeah.
Not really wanting to address the issues, only on a surface level, whatever's going to be enough to get him, to get the public to accept him again, kind of thing, right?
Right.
And that's, yeah, that's not a lot of genuine, you know, taking stock of your actions.
Mm-hmm.
Reminds me, I read an article about Charlie Rose,
mm-hmm.
and like, he's just, you know, these people, they live in denial too, right? Because his passion is like news. So he's working on news stories and stuff, or he's trying to write books, and but nobody's giving him the time of day now. But that's, so it, like you were saying before, they have all this money in the bank. But for these people, it's like, this was their passion.
Yeah.
And they screwed it up, basically. And now that's, but they still want to do it. Like Louis C.K., his true passion's stand-up comedy, right?
Right.
So he wants to continue doing that, but he's screwed it up so badly, should he have the opportunity to do that again, right?
You know? And well, one thing I'll say about Louis C.K. is that he's actually admitted that he did the things he's been accused of doing, which is far and above most other people. You know, I'm thinking of Kevin Spacey, who did that weirdo Frank Underwood video right before Christmas. So there's some sense in him that he needs to, if he needs to get back to that, maybe he thought if he just admitted it, it would be okay, it would blow over.
Mm-hmm.
But yeah, there is a piece of this missing too. These guys want to work. I understand that. I have passions, and, you know, passion sometimes keeps you going when the money isn't there. I don't have millions of dollars,
yeah.
But there has to be a grander understanding here that you have to do more than just, I don't know, take it. Take the punishment,
mm-hmm.
and then assume that that's the debt paid. And like, no, the debt is in paid isn't all those newswomen that Charlie Rose harassed, that left the business, that gave up their passion because they couldn't put up with toxic men like Charlie
mm-hmm.
Rose, or the women who gave up stand-up comedy, or the women who gave up animation, or the women who gave
mm-hmm.
up their acting dreams because of Harvey Weinstein.
Mm-hmm.
So that's pretty heavy.
Yeah, we're getting pretty heavy here. Yeah, these topics. Yeah, Lasseter... He's, you know, he shot himself in the foot, and
yeah.
I think Emma Thompson made some really good points there, right? Like, if he was to start his own company, then everybody knows what they're getting into.
Yeah.
But for him to be propped up in a position with another animation company.
And just on the promise of that he will comport himself, which is a word I enjoy, but in this
comport.
Type.
Did a great job comporting yourself. You're welcome back into the fray now.
That's right. Yeah, you're on comportment watch.
Yeah.
You get three strikes on comportment. Since we're livening it up a little, we'll address this ViewMaster movie that's now in the works. Now, it's been around... The ViewMaster, I didn't realize it had been around this long, because I remember it when I was a kid. I'm sure you remember.
Yeah, me too.
Yeah. The ViewMaster, it's this thing that you hold up to your eyes, a little circular slide goes in, and you look through it, and a 3D picture of
right.
state capitals or
yeah.
Disneyland or a scene from a movie you like or a TV show. I had a whole series of Indiana Jones ViewMaster.
Yeah, I think
reels.
I did too. Yeah, it was more like movies when I was a kid.
Yeah, but yeah. You know, it covered the gambit. They're somehow going to turn this into a movie. Which, first of all, Mattel has a production company. Mattel makes the ViewMaster. It's a toy company, and now they have a production company. Of course, they have other things in the works, because Mattel owns the Masters of the Universe action figure line, which has long been, they've been trying to make that into a movie again. There was a 1987 movie,
mm-hmm.
Masters of the Universe, cult classic, starring Dolph Lundgren as He-Man. Courtney
yeah.
Cox as a human friend, and I think Frank Langella as Skeletor. there's also Hot Wheels. Hot Wheels is owned by Mattel, but there's also been a Hot Wheels movie in the works for a long time. And Barbie, they've been working on a Barbie movie.
I'm surprised they haven't done a Barbie movie.
It's somewhat surprising that there hasn't been a Barbie movie.
Yeah.
Although, like, Amy Schumer was attached to that for a while.
Oh, really? Okay.
So it's... I don't like to say that I don't know how they would make a Viewmaster movie isn't to say that they can't make a Viewmaster movie.
Yeah.
But I'm already picturing, like, somebody finding a Viewmaster in the attic and then looking through it and then being transported to some sort of magical land.
I'm sold.
Sign me up. Give me $5 million for the pitch. But yeah. It's... I think these are the things that, you know, sort of make us hate Hollywood.
Yeah, right now. I think so. I think I would be interested because I had one as a kid, and it all comes down to, like, we all have our own interests. Like, there's stuff that other people mention. I have no idea what it is. And they're like, oh, they'll do a movie on Fortnite. Like, I'm not a big Pokemon person, so it's right. Like, Pokemon, and it's like it gets a cult because it brings back those childhood memories, right? Mm. And I think it could be a good movie. Like, the comparison was Lego. Mm-hmm. The Lego movie, everyone's like, how do you do a Lego movie? And then, you know, you put your imagination into it, and it could be good. And one corollary they're talking about was, like, virtual reality, right?
Mm.
Like, that was the original virtual reality in a way, right? Like,
yeah.
75 years ago, you can you can think you're visiting the Eiffel Tower through this device and stuff, but...
I mean, that could very well be a point. I find it a bit... I'm drawn both ways because the other end of this, too, is like when Disney started making movies about their rides or making movies out of their rides, and you had the Haunted Mansion, which wasn't successful, but you had the Pirates of the Caribbean movie, which was incredibly successful. And then you remember that, you know, Johnny Depp, back when he was an actor and before he was professionally harassing his ex-wife, won an Academy Award nomination for playing Captain Jack Sparrow in that first Pirates of the Caribbean movie. And it's like, well, you can take these incredibly base things, these base ideas, like we own a theme park ride, we're going to turn that into a movie because then we don't have to pay people for the idea because we already own it, and actually make something intriguing out of it. I just feel like it's summed up in the Slash Film headline, Viewmaster movie in the works will probably win Best Picture someday. And, I mean, don't count your chickens till they hatch is, I guess, the process I'm working through here. You never know.
Yeah, and I think there's just a gap with originality with a lot. Even though there's a lot of great content, especially for TV shows, but you don't, in movies especially, you don't see, like, there's remakes.
Mm-hmm.
Remake of a TV show becomes a movie, remake of an old movie becomes a new movie. And Viewmaster, I put in a similar category. It's just like, okay, here's something from your childhood. It's like doing let's do a Slinky movie or something, you know? Like, you know, it is at the root not. Doesn't seem like a very good idea. It just would depend what talent comes to it.
Right.
It could end up being a really good movie, like Lego movies or something, you know. Like,
it is interesting because I saw an interview with Alan Sepinwald, who's a TV critic. He was talking about how TV used to be mass market. It would just, like, be the lowest common denominator, and movies were where you get some variety. And now the whole thing's reversed, where the movies are the mass market, lowest common denominator thing. And if you want niche, you go to TV.
Exactly. Yeah.
Speaking of niche, our review coming up later is Stan and Ollie, so we're going to take a quick break and let you listen to some OG Stan and Ollie. We'll be right back with more end credits.
In the pale moonshine, our hearts entwine, where she carved her name, and I carved mine, or June, just like the mountains are blue, like the pine, I am lonesome for you.
In the Blue Ridge Mountains of Virginia, on the trail of the lonesome pine. In the pale moonshine, our hearts entwine, where she carved her name and I carved mine. Oh, June, like the mountains, I'm blue, like the pine. I am lonesome for you.
In the Blue Ridge Mountains of Virginia, trail of the lonesome pine.
And that's The Trail of the Lonesome Pine by Stan Laurel and Oliver Hardy. And we're going to talk about them briefly, but first, I'm sure if they are around today, somebody would be trying to kickstart or something out of a Laurel and Hardy movie.
Take off the bowler hats.
Get rid of the bowler hats.
Digitally remove them.
They're over the top. Yeah. Too much. It's too much. So I want to thank Vince for bringing this to my attention. Vince Masson, who's a co-host on the show. If you're wondering what specific Vince I was referring to. But yeah, so somebody started a Kickstarter campaign to raise $4,000 to buy the equipment and Blu-rays of The Departed and digitally erase the rat from the final scene. Now, if you forget how The Departed ends, it's about two moles. There's a state... Massachusetts State Police cop in with the mob, led by Jack Nicholson, and the mob has a mole inside the police, and that mole is played by Matt Damon. In the end, Mark Wahlberg, who's been one of the cops investigating, shoots Matt Damon in the head, and the camera pans up, and there's a rat scurrying across the windowsill because they're both rats. Am I crazy, or is this a waste of time?
It's a total waste of time, but that's what the internet's for. It's
apparently
for wasting your time. No, I don't want to paint it all with that brush, but yeah, it's the argument is that's obvious symbolism. I'm a big fan of The Departed. I think it's a masterpiece. I love that movie.
Yeah, it's great.
And yeah, it probably is obvious symbolism, but that's what I go for the movies for. There's all kinds of obvious symbolism in all movies, and for someone to spend this much time working on editing out a piece of a masterpiece, like, should work on their own ideas, you know? And I think that's an issue in recycled culture for a lot of things when it comes to film, music. It's like, there's so much out there that you can grab off the internet that you spend more time obsessed with stuff that's already been produced as opposed to producing your own stuff. It is kind of funny, like, that they're going after this one specific thing, just this rat at the end of the movie. But yeah, it is a waste of time. Yeah.
Like, well, I took a couple of things from sort of seeing reactions about this. One was I saw somebody online say, why don't you just shut it off after Mark Wahlberg shoots Matt Damon? That would solve a lot of problems. And the other thing is, I don't know if it's true or not, but somebody, I thought I saw somebody online infer this, the idea behind it was a joke, that to see if, like, people would actually do it. Because the basis of the Kickstarter was they would buy a copy of The Departed, throw away the disc inside it, put in the new disc with the rat edited out, and then they would send it to you. And I'm not entirely, like, it sounds jokey, but it, I mean, yeah, given that there was also this effort to raise money to remake Star Wars The Last Jedi that apparently raised $33 million, they Jeez. Say. I mean, they didn't do it through, like, typical channels like Kickstarter or Indiegogo or GoFundMe or anything like that. But, you know, those people were, like, deadly damn serious that Star Wars The Last Jedi was not their Star Wars movie, and somehow they were going to raise the $200 million to remake it and then convince, you know, Mark Hamill and John Boyega and everybody to come in and do it their way.
Yeah.
It's hard not to take this seriously, or it's that someone was joking. And subsequently, Warner Brothers, which owns The Departed, has shut this down because it's their IP. And
right. Yeah, you can't just go
It's stupid.
Around.
But yeah. So, it's hard not to take this seriously, I guess. I mean, it's hard not to take the idea that the people behind this were serious. If it was a joke, great job. You managed to convince 4,000 people who are really angry, $4,000 worth of people who are really angry about that rat to give you money.
Or they think it's really funny, because that's the
thing,
right?
That could
be
it,
too. It's like, oh, this is so funny. I'm going to...
I want the rat list. Departed.
But yeah, like, when you're talking $33 million for The Last Jedi, that's crazy. Like, where does that money end up? They must have to, like... reimburse it back to the people, or?
Well, if that's what how much they raised. I mean, that's the thing, is that there was no sort of metrics. Because when you go to like a Kickstarter page, you can actually see the little thermometer of how much money, or through Patreon or whatever service you use. But when, you know, when you're just putting it out there, when you just have a website and you're going on Twitter and saying we have $33 million in the bank so far, you know, who's to say if that isn't, you know, Monopoly money?
Yeah. Yeah. It's great. It's just, you know, I've seen on YouTube some great, works where people have done their own music videos, or they've re-edited films or parts of films. And, you know, it's fun. It's a good experience. Like, if you're doing it for experience to learn about editing, or to put something on your reel maybe, or then that's cool. But, like, to just say, we just want to take this rat out of here, just to be snarky, it's kind of funny, but it's kind of...
Right.
Everything that's wrong as well, I think.
And you make a good point, because part of the culture now is, like, taking it's a bit like remixing and sampling. And you know, when hip-hop started to evolve, it feels like we're very much there with video and film material. Because you know, I was watching something on YouTube last week, which was the LL Cool J theme music from Deep Blue Sea, but someone, instead of the scenes from Deep Blue Sea, somebody put in scenes from Jaws. So it's called. So the video is called LL Cool Jaws, and it's really funny, really well done.
Yeah.
Probably not going to monetize that.
Yeah.
Because you know, you're bringing in Universal Studios, which owns Jaws, and LL Cool J, who owns his music. It's you know, where does fun end, and you know, where does having the responsibility to the fact that the Martin Scorsese and Warner Brothers owns this thing, and the fact that you're basically saying, I know better than Martin Scorsese. You may disagree with his decision, but it was Martin Scorsese's movie, Martin Scorsese's direction.
Yeah.
And that's the way he wanted to end that movie. And it's, you know, the same with Last Jedi. You may not like Last Jedi. You may think Rian Johnson didn't do a good job, but a big, huge multinational media corporation got behind him and funded his vision. And if you feel differently, you know, present your vision and people will decide whether to fund that vision or not.
And the cool thing about art, film, everything is when you see flaws, like there's even masterpieces, ones that are considered like AFI's top 10 films of all time. You watch it and you're like, oh, that scene really didn't need to be there.
Right.
But it kind of adds to it because you see like warts and all. And actually, for years, I've had sort of a problem with all these director's cuts of films, too, right? It's always like, aren't you happy? Just keep it the way it was. You know, you're always tinkering. And, like, once it's there, you know, I think it's a masterpiece. The rat is kind of over the top. I don't mind it, though. You know, like, it's literally, how long is it on? For, like, a second or two at the end of the film? Just walking across the
window, just the camera pans up and you see the rat, like, running across or squeaking across the window pane.
Yeah.
But, I mean, a lot of directors do this, and I've talked a lot about Steven Spielberg, how Steven Spielberg will whack the hammer over your head as the movie comes to a close. With the, like, The Post, where it ends with Tom Hanks and Meryl Streep, and Meryl Streep is the publisher of the Washington Post. She says, you know, heaven forbid we live through anything like this ever again. And it smash cuts to somebody breaking into the Watergate. And, you know, if you know the history, you know that the joke that Meryl Streep is getting at is that, you know, in a couple of years, the Washington Post would be embroiled again with a Nixon administration scandal.
Mm-hmm.
I get it.
Yeah.
But Spielberg says, there might be a lot of people who don't know about Watergate.
Yeah.
So we have to, like, do it. And, you know, the same thing about Black Klansman. I think Black Klansman's a masterpiece, but God knows Spike Lee wants to make sure we draw a straight line from the Colorado Ku Klux Klan in the 70s to Donald Trump in 2019.
Yeah.
So maybe we should... I can't imagine the full of black if we started a Kickstarter about editing out the Charlottesville montage at the end of Black Klansman. But
yeah, I kind of want to get in some hot water there.
That's putting it mildly. So speaking of hot water, Rotten Tomatoes took an unusual step of switching off certain aspects of their site when it comes to Captain Marvel, which comes out this weekend. Captain Marvel is the, I want to say, 21st or 22nd Marvel movie, but it's the first one to feature a solo female superhero in the form of Brie Larson as Captain Marvel. But a lot of people were downvoting the movie. The Rotten Tomatoes keeps a little thing where you can vote how much you're looking forward to seeing a movie, but a lot of trolls were downvoting it. I guess apparently the idea of a female superhero is bad. Mm. Of course, this also happened with Black Panther. It also happened with the all-female Ghostbusters from Paul Feig. Mm-hmm. I don't know. This goes back to the Star Wars thing too. A lot of people were upset about Last Jedi because there were such prominent roles for people of color, for women. Mm-hmm. I don't know what to say about this anymore.
It's just a lot of angry trolls, and it seems to be the whole culture is so very black and white now. It's like you're either on the side, this side or that side, and it seems a lot of anger. And I read further about this, and I think some of the anger stems from the fact that Brie Larson had mentioned that when she's being interviewed, it tends to be white males who are interviewing her, and she'd like to see more diversity in the media and the film media. And so then after that, it went from like 90% anticipation rate to like 58%.
Yeah.
It's just, once again, it's do people have better things to do with their time? Like, I actually wish these people were working on taking the rat out of The Departed.
Yes.
There's degrees of wasting your life. Right. If they could spend time taking the rat out of The Departed, I think the world would be a better place, actually.
Or making LL Cool Jaws or something. I don't know what it is that the idea of more diversity is just so frightening. And I'm reading over Brie Larson's quote about, I think she said it to Marie Claire. I don't think she was arguing the point that, and she came out later and refined that. She said she wasn't making the point that people should lose jobs. She was talking about, I think her exact quote, she just wanted to add chairs, not take chairs away. Mm-hmm. And speaking as someone who's been a part of that film media, I've been at roundtables, scrums, these events, and you are one of many white faces, white male faces, and that has been the way that the industry has looked for a good long time. And when you see people react to, somebody like Rachel Leishman of the Mary Sue, who sent out a tweet where she had a picture of Gal Gadot talking to a young girl in a Wonder Woman costume and Brie Larson signing an autograph for a young girl in a Captain Marvel costume. She said, these movies aren't for the people who are so dead set against them. They're not even for people like her who is a geek girl and looking forward to these movies. They're for the young girls who have someone to look up to, look up to... Wonder Woman made flesh thanks to Gal Gadot, and look up to Captain Marvel made flesh thanks to Brie Larson. Mm-hmm. They can see themselves on the big screen. And people had this, I don't know what, but all these trolls like Piranha just, sort of form up on her. It's like, how dare you say this is not meant for me?
Yeah.
It's like, well, not everything's meant for everybody, right?
Yeah.
I'm not an anime fan. I've never been able... I'm talking about Battle Angel Alita last week, or Alita Battle Angel, because anyway. I've never been an anime guy, but I've never been upset about it. I don't see someone in an anime costume at Fan Expo and go like, I don't get that, and I want you to take it off right now.
Yeah. Well, the thing is, these people wouldn't do that either. They wouldn't.
No, they wouldn't do
it face to
face. That's exactly right.
You can use whatever identity you want on the web, and you don't see the repercussions usually. So that's what people are doing, right? It's just like voting down. Just use the thumbs down.
And I think that's so important, is that face to face. Because I've been to so many cons over the years. I have never seen anybody in a Q&A get up and go, you are terrible, you are bringing down the culture, why do you suck? And a follow-up question, why do you suck so hard? It's it is there is something to the online portion of this that just allows people to let the most vile thoughts and expressions take over.
Yeah, they can do it at like 2 a.m. and just like faceless behind your laptop, just mm-hmm. type whatever you want.
Mm-hmm.
And it's easy to hit thumbs down or say, I don't want to see this movie. And, you know, it takes, I guess, one influencer from that side says something.
And it takes one Spartacus, and then, it, you know, you get 50,000 other people going, well, I am Spartacus, too. I hate Captain Marvel.
Yeah, exactly.
It's, I don't understand it. And I spent a lot of time on this show and through my own writings and my own thoughts, like trying to work through this, you know, and you know, I've received some of this. I gave a positive review to Ghostbusters on a site I work for, the Paul Feig Ghostbusters, and people are calling me like a Sony shill, and it's just like, why? Because I enjoyed a movie.
Yeah, it's insane. I think back to like Breaking Bad and Skyler, the wife.
Yes.
And it's a character, you know, and even she was even justified in her character with what she did,
right,
given what her husband was doing. And then everybody, all this hate just rained down on her. It's just craziness. It's like, for one thing, she's a character. And for another thing, she's probably doing the right thing, trying to get away from, like in whatever, season 3 or 4, whatever, she's trying to get away from her meth dealing.
Yeah, like sociopathic drug kingpin husband. Yeah. It's spoiler alert for Breaking Bad. but yeah, that's another great example that, you know, I can't remember the actress's name off the top of my head. But yeah, a lot of people hated her guts.
Yeah.
For being the wife of a drug dealer in a TV show. I don't know. And as somebody pointed out too, we have Chris Evans who plays Captain America. He hasn't been too terribly silent on what he thinks about politics in the United States right now. And everyone's like, you get him, Captain America, because Chris Evans and Captain America are the same person, I guess. But Brie Larson, heaven forbid, talks about, you know what, I wouldn't mind going to a junket and seeing some more female faces and faces of color. And she is the devil, and she must be brought down to account.
Yeah.
It's crazy.
Yeah, it's insane. And then the fact that you just do that on Rotten Tomatoes. I think Rotten Tomatoes, though, could do some work on, like, the whole, like, their whole, I want to see this score. It's like, how much value does that add, really, you know? Like,
a counterpoint, I think we all need to stop taking Rotten Tomatoes so seriously.
Well, yeah, because it's totally, you can have a mediocre movie that's just good enough.
Yeah.
And it'll be fresh.
Yeah.
Because 80% of critics will say, oh, this is a pretty good movie.
Yeah.
And then you see, oh, 80% Rotten Tomatoes, like... I can't believe people judge just based on that, whether they want to see a movie.
Well, if you want to see Stan and Holly, you'll have to judge what we have to say coming up next. We're going to review that movie after the break. You're listening to End Credits here on CFRU 93.3 FM, CFRU.ca, Guelph Campus and Community Radio.
I will be touchable by her. I will be reachable. I couldn't tell you where my head goes either. But it wanders to the night where I'm not all here, and there's no car. When you touch me, I wonder, I always wonder what you could want with me.
Manhood has about stealing from the rich and giving to the poor. There's a gag there somewhere, isn't there?
Babe, the girl's going to be waiting for us downstairs. Delphine wants us to meet these people from his charity.
Never mind about them. They're not going anywhere. We just need to work through this just a little bit more. Hey, when is Muffin coming to see the show?
He didn't say.
He should have been here tonight. Went big tonight. That was a crackerjack, wasn't it?
It was.
All right. How about this? How about we tell Robin Hood, you've got it all wrong. You ought to steal from the poor and giving to the rich or something like that.
That's not right. No, it's...
Well, what is it?
Well, all right. Okay.
Oh, you got
how about this? Okay, how about this? Okay, I tap you on the shoulder and I say, Ollie, I got an idea. How about we give to the poor by stealing from the poor? That way we cut out the middleman.
That's it.
That's it.
All right.
Stealing from the rich to give to the poor. Whoever heard of such a ridiculous idea?
Well, it's communism.
Or socialism, as we would say now. All right, that was a clip from Stan and Ollie. It's a new film from John S. Bard, and it stars Steve Coogan, John C. Reilly, Nina Arietta, Shirley Henderson, Rufus Jones, and Danny Houston. We were talking a bit about this, that we both aware of Laurel and Hardy, but wasn't part of my Hollywood upbringing. I went from The Three Stooges, which I remember was on CKVR from Barrie every Sunday morning. They would play a couple hours of Three Stooges. But then I went from that as a kid, then I graduated to the Marx Brothers. Hmm. Which I still enjoy. I was actually watching The Coconuts last night.
Oh, cool.
It was still funny.
Yeah.
Still works.
Yeah. For me, Laurel and Hardy, they were like a household name. And I do recall watching a couple of their films, but to tell you the truth, I thought they were both British. I didn't know that Hardy was American, so I learned that through this film and watching it. But they're originals, and I think I really want to invest in watching more of their films than I watched this film, because definitely had some funny routines, that's for sure.
Yeah, definitely. They, it's funny how they worked in the routines too. I'm not sure if they did this as like real people or if this was like a conceit of the movie, where they would, you know, come into the hotel and check into the hotel but doing one of their routines, with like the ringing of the bell or the switching of the hats kind of thing. But one of the best gags I think in the film, and I'm not sure if it was like them like doing one of their bits or just like how things happen serendipitously, but when they're dragging the big trunk up the stairs and one of them asks, you know, for the time or something, and then the trunk goes all the way back down the stairs, that there was a lot of time and dedication to I think really delivering that comedic timing. And I think that is like the real gift, is that I felt that Coogan and O'Reilly, they weren't just filling the part. Like, they weren't just like doing a caricature, that they were really playing these guys. They were playing real characters.
Yeah, they're playing real human beings. It was really interesting to watch. I really, really liked John C. Reilly as Hardy. He was so understated, yet very funny, and just very, very tender in the way he took on the role. You can see that he did some quite a bit of research, and he was really wanted to portray this man the way he was. And it's an understated movie. It has funny moments, but it's not like blow your socks off funny kind of thing.
Yeah.
Which I actually thought of the movie after watching it. It's like, I kind of would watch this again. Like 5 years from now, I'd probably watch it again, because it's really sweet, but it's really well done, and it's like effortless the way the film was done, and the performances all gel together well. Like, I mean, you have Laurel and Hardy as Coogan and Reilly, but you also have their wives.
Yes,
are such great characters.
Mm-hmm.
Like, Laurel's married to this Russian ex-dancer
yeah.
who tells everybody she danced in a Preston Sturges movie or a couple of them, and she'll tell anybody who will listen that, but she's just great. And they're both protective. Both the wives are so protective of their husbands, and they want to make sure that they get the most out of their talent, the most money, the most recognition.
I think one of the booker, the guy who's sort of marshaling their tour through Britain, says at one point that they're a double act. Mm-hmm. And that really comes through, because Henderson plays Mrs. Hardy, Arianda plays Mrs. Laurel. I got that right. And, you know, they work together with you know, Coogan and Riley. But they also work really great together themselves as their own separate act. Mm-hmm. Because Mrs. Laurel is this, as you said, this over-the-top character, very outgoing, very gregarious, and Mrs. Hardy is much more demure, much more also a bit saltier in terms of protecting protecting Ollie, or Babe, which was apparently was his nickname.
Yeah, like Babe Ruth, I guess. Right?
That may be where it's maybe like if you were a husky back in the 30s, they would call you Babe. That requires more research. probably not, but anyway, I'll throw it out there. It's really interesting watching those players line up, because I feel like the movie takes on a whole new dimension when the wives arrive.
Mm-hmm.
And it's not just sort of, it almost feels like the first half of the movie kind of feels like one of Coogan's sort of, one of his trip movies, I think it's also a TV show where he's like going to different places with, I can't remember who he's traveling with, but there's always like jokes along the way and fine dining and location porn and all that. and there's definitely a feeling to that, but when, it's when the wives arrive that, you know, all the personal stuff comes out and the fact that they were separate entities for a time, and that Laurel's artistic integrity, frankly, which was something you could hard to stand up for at the time, basically cost them years of working together because he and Hardy were under separate contracts. And this is something I didn't appreciate, is that they weren't always a team.
No.
Like the Marx Brothers or the Three Stooges, that they were put together.
Yeah.
And kismet happens. And
yeah.
I mean, and that's another, I think, gift of the film, is that, you know, you never can anticipate who your great collaborator is going to be.
Right. Like the director, Hal Roach, put them together.
Yeah.
He just said, these guys look like they would work well together.
Yeah.
You know, good comedy team. You've got the thin man and the fat man. But the funny thing that I didn't appreciate either is it wasn't like with Abbott and Costello, mm-hmm. right? Abbott's the straight man. Costello is the live wire.
Mm-hmm.
With these guys, it was more, they were both could go over the top and both could play the straight man.
Yeah.
And Laurel, he mentions in it that he worked with Charlie Chaplin early in his career, and I did some more research. He was actually the understudy for Charlie Chaplin.
Oh, yeah.
So just shows his talent and gifts, and he wore the bowler hat too, and he, you know, had the same sort of walk as well. It's very interesting to learn that. And as I said before, I thought they were both British. So then you have Hardy, which John C. Reilly plays, who's an American. And he's from Georgia.
Yeah.
And I just, I can't say enough. I think John C. Reilly's performance was great playing this gentleman. Because another thing about this movie, it isn't during their prime.
Yeah.
It's in the 50s. Their prime is like 20s, 30s.
Yeah.
And now this is taking place in the 50s when they're doing tours of England.
Mm-hmm.
And they're playing these small theaters. They used to be top names in the industry. Now they're playing small theaters where 20 people are coming to see them.
Yeah.
And they're just really working, really grinding it out with the promise that there'll be this movie deal at the end of the rainbow.
Yeah.
From, you played the clip from this guy, Muffin.
Muffin.
It's actually Miffin.
Yeah.
But Hardy calls him Muffin.
Yeah.
and you know, just, it's great because they're getting older, and John C. Reilly, he's playing this character who's sick. He's obese. He's obviously not in good shape, and he plays him with great like empathy, and
mm-hmm.
just plays him so natural. And I think Coogan plays it really naturally too, because I've seen him in some other films.
Yes.
Where I'm not the biggest fan, where he's just trying too hard to be funny, for me anyway.
Hamlet too.
Yeah. Yeah, stuff like that, right? Whereas in this, he's more drawn back and just playing it naturally, which I think just adds to the story and just the tenderness of it.
I would agree with all that. I find this is an interesting time for all those sort of old comedy teams. You know, there's a scene where Hardy walks past the billboard for Abbott and Costello Go to Mars,
mm-hmm.
which is, you know, Abbott and Costello still working, you know, in Hollywood at the time, but, you know, they were doing these, like, over-the-top things, like Abbott and Costello Meet Frankenstein and mm-hmm. Abbott and Costello Meet the Wolfman. And
yeah.
It almost reminds you of, like, the cinematic universe stuff of today, almost.
Yeah.
But, you know, the Three Stooges as well at this time were, I think they were on their third Stooge. This was after Curly had died, mm-hmm. after Shemp had died. Interesting thing about Three Stooges, Shemp was actually the first third Stooge. And then Shemp departed and they brought in Curly. So a lot of people think Shemp was a poor Curly substitute. Well, no, actually, Curly was a great Shemp substitute.
Yeah.
Leaving that there.
You have to know your history.
You have to know your history. You know, this was a hard time because they was making the transition away from short films, which is how a lot of those guys made their bank with the short films. Of course, TV was sort of taking over that realm. You know, these acts were seen as, you know, vestiges of the past, and you know, going with new acts. Mm-hmm. It's a tough time, and I think that really comes through in the movie, that these people who were. It speaks to, you know, there is a time for everything, and you could be great on top of the world, the biggest moneymakers in Hollywood today, but just 20 years later, you're trying to fill, you know, 200-seat theaters in the middle of nowhere, Ireland.
Yeah, and there's a great scene where there's this older lady in this small theater hall, and she says to the box office, she asks, who's playing Laurel and Hardy?
Yeah.
And they're like, no, it's actual Laurel and Hardy. No, she's like, who's playing Laurel and Hardy in this? It's been 20 years. Who's playing them? And then they show up, Laurel and Hardy, and she's just like gobsmacked. And she's like,
front seat in the front row.
I want a seat in the front row. This is awesome.
Yeah, because, I mean, it's pre-internet days, too. Mm-hmm. You know, we sort of enjoy taking the piss out of people who sort of fall from grace. But, you know, I guess at the time it was probably unimaginable that, you know, big stars like Laurel and Hardy would take the time to go and tour. And the fact of the matter is that was all they could do. If they wanted to make a living doing what they did best, then they had to lower themselves, I guess. I mean, work is work. And this was clearly a passion for them. But it does make me a bit sad because, as you were saying, this is like really effortless work. It's not flashy. Mm-hmm. It's just very well put together and very enjoyable. And it's like 90 minutes long, too. So it's not even like, it doesn't have that like pomposity, that prestigiousness that you think like something like this would carry. It's a very workman-like effort. Mm-hmm. And everybody does a great job. And I think that's why, because this was actually screened at TIFF last fall, and there was this, you know, big thing like, who's going to buy the Laurel and Hardy biopic? Because it's going to be a big awards thing, and it actually, that didn't come to pass. And I think that's sad. But I think it's because it's not flashy at all.
Yeah, because it's understated. It's like understated. If they added another 15 minutes on, and they had like Hardy, like sick and like you know, talking about regrets or something, or you know, there's a way they could have probably, you know, been fodder for awards, but they weren't really going for that, which I think makes it more interesting. And that's why I said like 5 years from now, I'd probably want to watch it again, because it's not like something I'll lose interest in.
It just strikes me as odd, because you had a number of biopics at the Oscars. You had Vice, you had Bohemian Rhapsody. Mm-hmm. And those, there's a lot of flash there in those, but I don't think they get to the heart of those characters in the way that this does, which really makes you realize just how much flash and you know, the sheen of some of those efforts can cover the fact that they don't really, you know, answer any sort of quandary about who this person was and what made them, and you know, Vice is very meta. It deals with one of the most controversial figures of modern history, but I don't think you walk away from that knowing more about Dick Cheney in quite the same way as you walk in to Stan and Laurel and leave knowing a bit more about Laurel and Hardy and maybe appreciating them in a way that you hadn't before.
Yeah. And the key difference is that there's admiration for Laurel and Hardy by the There's no filmmakers.
Admiration for Dick Cheney.
Yeah, exactly. So
nobody's saying we need a man like Dick Cheney again.
Nobody's like pining for the days of Dick Cheney, you know? Like.
Yes. That's a whole other discussion. That's it for this show. We hope you liked it. You can find us on our website, endcreditsradioshow.com, for this and past episodes. You can find us on Facebook at End Credits Radio Show or on Twitter at End Credits Radio. And Tim, where can people find you on the internets?
Flash in the Deadpan on Twitter, Facebook, and Instagram.
And you can find him in Vegas doing a residency after
this
marriage.
I will be, yes.
I'm kidding.
Downtown.
Downtown.
I'll be doing the Laurel and Hardy act that I've developed myself after watching the movie.
It's a one-man show,
it
Laurel
is,
and Hardy.
Yes.
That'd be interesting.
Yeah. Stay it's tuned a lot of mirrors.
That can be said about so many things in Vegas, but we digress. I'll be back here tomorrow on CFRU, Thursday at 5 p.m. for Open Sources Guelph with Scotty Hertz. You can find me on Twitter and Instagram at Adam A. Donaldson, or you can visit my political site at guelphpolitico.ca. Stay tuned for more great programming here on CFRU, 93.3 FM, CFRU.ca, Guelph Campus and Community Radio, and we will be back here next Wednesday at 2 p.m. for more end credits, and we'll see you then.